If you went to Ceylon to become enlightened, and you went into a Theravadan monastery, you would walk in and you'd say, I want to become enlightened, see? And they'd say, well, that's very nice. And they'd take you to a little room. You'd go into the room and they'd say, now, would you notice that when you breathe in, your abdomen goes up. And when you breathe out, your abdomen goes down. And you, yes, I noticed that. Continue to notice that. Thank you. And they leave you. Food's brought to you. 2 weeks later, guy comes in. How are you doing? Doing with what? You've been watching your abdomen go up and down? Oh, I watched for you. Didn't mean I was... Thank you very much. That's the work. All right, now let's say your only assignment in life, see, is to watch your abdomen go up and down. And every time it goes up, you think rising, and every time it goes down, you think falling. That's your job. See, like I do this every morning. I sit in meditation, and I start out. And since I'm a high Western achiever, I count. See? And I know how hung up I am when I begin, so I know I'm going to have to do 500 to get straight today, or 1,000 to get straight today. Om, one. Om, two. Om, three. Om, four. What an idiotic thing to be doing. Om, five. Om, six. Geez, my leg hurts. Om, seven. Om, eight. I should have gone to the bathroom before. Om, nine. Om, ten. Om, 11. You think this works? Om, 12. For this, I got a PhD. Om, 13. And on and on and on. Now what happens is, I'm just giving you the little thoughts you can flick off, see? But the really seductive ones, they really take you on the trip, you see? Like, you hear, there's a noise outside, and you say, what was that? See, and that seems like a legitimate reason. And you can keep right on counting, and you're thinking about what is it, and who is it, and that leads you to that thing, and I gotta get the car greased, and you're off and running, see? And then you wait, oh, wow, I was supposed to be counting to five. suddenly at 93, how did I get here, see? Don't knock yourself, that's just more jazz. 94, 95, 96. And then pretty soon you get so that the breaks are only like about 60 instead of 100, you see, where you forgot. And you keep pushing it down and pushing it down and pushing it down. You take this most mechanical, stupid thing, see. That's exactly what you need to foil the mind, is just simplicity itself. And your game is to treat all thoughts like clouds. There is not one thought worthy of having at that during that period of time other than rising and falling, or you're counting. Okay? And after a while, when you really get good at it, you get down to a place where all there is that place in your abdomen going up, coming down, going up, coming down, going up, coming down. And in your head is rising, falling, rising, falling. Rising, falling. But before that happens, you get to the point where you see the thousands of thoughts going by, just like clouds in the sky, just going over. But the thing is that because of your commitment, they have no leverage to hold you. While previously, every thought had as much right as every other thought to hold you. Why did you give preeminence to one over another? And it's only when you can make your mind thoroughly one-pointed, bring it down to one place. This is the first requirement of this game. First requirement of the game is to bring the mind down to one point. And then the game is to work with the energies in the body and learn how to control them and move them up your spine and through your nerves and so on. And then you turn, push the energy through that one pointedness and turn the one pointedness back in on itself. And you go through the doorway. So what the game is you go from many subjects and many objects to one subject and many objects to making that subject object, and then it all becomes subject. You grok it all. Right? You are one with it all. That's the root. That's the root of Gyan Yoga, the yoga of the intellect. You see, when you've been getting high lots, and you know where high is, Highville, Heliopolis, you know, the place, Satchitananda, you know that it has certain qualities. One is that it is not in time. It is not in time. It's in eternal time. The other is that it's not in, there is no subject and object. There's no subject and object. So if you want to create the universe of high to live in, you've got to work with time and you've got to work with subject-object. I'm just giving these as clues. We won't get into that at the moment. Except to say this, that the first purification things in what I'm doing include, the first one is non-killing, non-stealing, non-lying, non-giving and receiving of gifts, and sexual continence. The continence one is too big a topic to play with at this moment. But let's take to the others because they all fit together. If I have anything going in my head that keeps you him, we cannot be high together. Because if we're going to be high together, we've got to be us. And as long as there is subject-object, it won't work. Now imagine what it is like to live in a world where everybody is us. Everybody is us. There's no them at all. There's no them at all. This is a big one. This is a very big one. This is a very big clue. It's a clue. It is a clue. Time and subject-object are two major clues to becoming a conscious being at this moment. Take sex. There are three levels at which you can have sex. There is Sam and Mary making it with each other. Your personality turns me on. An interpersonal thing. Are you happy? Was it fun? Did you enjoy it? Etc. We're having fun together. There is the yin-yang, the level of polarization of forces, the biological magnetic fields. Both of those are subject-object. Those are both what the Easterners mean by the word lust. That is, desiring something in the subject-object sense. There is a third level at which the two of us become one, and from this one place, one consciousness, and two bodies, then we perform a dance, and that dance creates the energy which we feed in to keep us as one. Hear that? That's very, very high stuff. Very high stuff. Very high stuff. Anything in you which makes you see somebody else as him or her is the reason you're not high all the time. Is the reason you are not conscious all the time. Consciousness all the time means total compassion for how it is in the universe at every moment. Compassion means total empathy with how it all is. It means grokking it. Just as you understand how your hand works, you understand how it all is because you are it all, because your ego is not getting in the way, because your desires are not distorting what it's all about, because you're not identified with your desires. If you are horny and walk down the street, all you see is what's makeable. If you're hungry and walk down the street, all you see is what's edible. If you're an achiever and you walk down the street, all you see is who's competitive with, or what you can achieve on, about. Desires, motives affect perception. And we know that from social psychology. The only thing in social psychology that we don't know is that there's an out. I was teaching from a social psychology book, which was a good, respectable social psychology book just 7 years ago, that said man is the sum of his social roles. Wow. Rough karma. Rough karma. See, and the funny, peculiar position we're caught in is that many of us have touched a possibility and we are awake to how beautiful it is and we want it to be beautiful, but we want it so bad that our want, our desire, corrupts our efforts. That's the situation we find ourselves in. Because it is as obvious as the nose on one's face when you look at protests that the protesters create the people who just against whom they're protesting. that as long as you are identified in the polarity and attached at the polarized position, you create your polar opposite. If I see you as him, that puts into you a reaction that sees me as him, and there we are, separate. And only can I say, I disagree with you when I understand that you and I are one. And that's the basis from which I'm working. See? Only when you can say, yes, Richard Nixon is us, and J. Edgar Hoover is us, and Mao is us, and Chiu Minh is us, and on and on and on. And the hippie is us, and the speed freak is us, and the heroin addict is us, and the psychotic is us, then we can get on with it. It's a reversal of figure and ground. It's going from the position where you are completely addicted to individual differences, which is what the Western trip is, to the point where you, and I use Western trip only to mean rational materialism. It is not unique to the West, except it's the Greek-Roman trip, except for some of the mystical elements in Plato and Heraclitus. And as long as you're into individual differences, you're into subject and object. And you flip it over and you see in which they are all the same. I'm driving along in New York State and a policeman stops me because I've got a very old 1938 car and it looks weird. And I've got a long beard and I look funny. And I've got a funny license plate and it's all strange and there's a stop and frisk law. And so he stops me. And he comes up and he says, license and registration. And he is being him. He's being policeman. What I am doing is doing my mantra. I'm doing a centering device, a heuristic device for keeping me centered in the place where we are one. And I hand him my license and registration, and at the same moment I am here. I am not identified with him who is handing the license and registration. Right. This is going to be very pure, or it doesn't work, I'll tell you, by the way. I don't come on to him to look how beautiful I am, I'm a flower child, or, you know, why are you a policeman? Come on, be groovy. No hustle. I don't say a word. We'd never miss a step in the Lila Rasa, in the divine dance. He's doing his policeman thing. I'm doing my far out unusual person. I'm just kindly giving him my license. And he says, do you have any guns in the car? And I say, no, I don't have any guns in the car. Any drugs in the car? No, I don't have any drugs in the car. What's in that? And I say, these are some mints. Would you like a mint? And all the time, I'm right here, right here. It's a psychic place. It is not, it's a vibrational rate, by the way, I'm talking about. I am right here. And after about 3 minutes, he begins to dig he's in the wrong place. Because he's busy being a policeman. But the fact is that all of us are busy with our melodramas. We're all in Peyton Place, you see. But behind our roles in Peyton Place, which were just determined by central casting for the evening, like, you, there are a lot of parts for audience tonight. Who wants to play? Right. Come over as audience. All right. We need one holy man left over from Christmas. Right. The end of the evening, take your bread and go home. It's all over. Great. We played our parts well. Everybody playing their part? Are you busy listening? Right. Watch it. Don't get caught. Just because you're going to play Hamlet, don't be Hamlet. Because here we all are. All of us are right here in a place where we are noting him speaking and him listening and her listening. You can be in the melodrama or you can see the melodrama going down, and here we all are too, right? This is a psychic space. I'm just doing my inside. The funny thing is, all the time I'm talking to you, I'm not talking to you at all. I mean, it's very far out and you may feel gypped. He never came that night. Watch it. Because inside, all I'm doing is, oh, money, fed me, hung out, 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 money, fed me, which I've been doing for about a year and a half. And it's going on in my bowels, and it's like inflating a room inside me where I am. It's like a cave. It's a groovy heart cave. It's called a Hridayam, and I hang out in the cave, and I hang out with Buddha, with Christ, with Ramakrishna, with Ramana Maharshi, with anybody else that wants to come out of their melodrama and be in the cave. It's not located in time and space. And here I am, and I'm watching this whole thing go down. I'm watching him speak. So I'm with the policeman, and pretty soon he begins to sense that there is a nicer place to be than where he is. Right here. And all I can say is, as I drove away, which is very unlike state troopers, he was waving at me, saying, "Goodbye, Richard, have a good trip." Because finally, we're dealing with the variables that concern just humanness. They don't concern individual differences anymore. The toughest deputy sheriff in the southern community in the United States, the meanest guy that eats nails, still wants to live in love. He wants to live in warmth. He wants to live in beauty. He wants to feel that feeling. And what technology and what our rational materialism and what the manifestation of all of our thought has led us to believe is that through gratification of the senses and through the thinking mind, we would get to that place. But finally, we begin to realize it's not going to make it. And at that point, it starts to fall away. And then you start to go inside. And then you find out, lo and behold, in here, here we all are again. Except we're really here. Really here. Really here. All the Westerner needs is the faith in the possibility of a higher state of consciousness to equal the faith he has had in his rational mind. And slightly greater than that in order to allow him to do the next step. Without that faith, nothing can happen. It's got to be a faith which undercuts the cynicism. The cynicism says there's nothing more than this round, baby, so take what you can get. Because when you die, you're dead. But who in fact we are has nothing whatsoever to do with that. It's very much like you were in a factory in Detroit and you drove out of the factory, or a factory that makes cars, and you drove out of the factory and the door closed on the factory, and you found yourself in the existential predicament, except you didn't know who you were, because everything you forgot, when the door closed, you forgot everything preceding that. So all there is this car. And the gate opens and you drive on the road, and for years you drive on the roads and you stop at gas stations and drive-ins and so on. And if somebody says, "Who are you?" you say, "I am a Chevrolet Corvair." And you look at fields, but you can't go there because you break your springs. And when you go by those car lots where they take cars and they make them in little steel squares, you get uptight because planned obsolescence and all. And then a voice comes along and says, "Hey, buddy, did you ever see that?" You say, "What's that?" "That's a door handle." "What's that for?" "Well, that's to get out of the car." "What do you mean, get out of the car? Who? I am a Chevrolet Corvair. Come on now, what are you doing putting me on?" "No, man, that's the illusion. That's the illusion that keeps nature doing its dance. You can open the door and get out." That's exactly the way it is, exactly the way it is. And remember, this has nothing to do with what you do in the external world. Don't get into funny places about it's not socially responsible. Because whoever it is sitting here doing his thing. Got here on time? He's a rent-a-robot. I move him from place to place. He's like a Charlie McCarthy doll. I watch with awe as this terrible beauty of nature goes down. All of it. All of it. Life, death, birth, love, hate, all the polarities. You know what's another identity with energy and consciousness is the word love. An exact identity. In fact, when you get to the top of the pyramid, they all become one. That's what Plato's pure idea is. That's that place back up there. Love, energy, consciousness, truth, beauty, wisdom, it all becomes one at that place. Meher Baba says, a very beautiful saint from India, Love has to spring spontaneously from within, and it is in no way amenable to any form of inner or outer force. Love and coercion can never go together, but though love cannot be forced on anyone, it can be awakened in him through love itself. Love is essentially self-communicative. Those who do not have it catch it from those who have it. True love is unconquerable and irresistible, and it goes on gathering power and spreading itself until eventually it transforms everyone whom it touches. Being is dying by loving is a true statement. That is the statement of bhakti yoga, the yoga of love, of devotion. If you ever have experienced being so in love with somebody that you are more concerned about their happiness than your own, you loved yourself right out of your egocentricity, you understand bhakti yoga. Because the minute you turn that to loving in another person or in the universe, that which is universal rather than that which is finite, you don't love Mary because she's Mary, and you don't love Mary because she's got a beautiful bod. You love Mary because she's God. And you honor her and worship her, and you're making love to her as a form of worship. And everything else you do all day long and everything 24 hours a day is a form of worship, of making the profane sacred. That's what it's all about. You want to be high, just change your consciousness around. You want it bad enough, you'll do it. It's work, but it's totally joyful work. Imagine, all you got to do is love everything. That's not bad. But you see, the funny thing is, it is not the verb love, because the verb love takes an object. Love who? If I love that thing in Mary, which is God, what is it that loves it? It's the thing in me, which is God, and that thing is one. In fact, the rule of the game, the statement I can also make is, if you know who you are and I know who I am, at this moment in this auditorium, there is only one of us. There is only one of us. And all these manifestations. See? And here I am. All of us. Here we are. Here I am. We, I, is the same.